In Washington this afternoon, four distinguished ambassadors from all over the world sat down together to discuss the prospects for peace, a subject on which our future and even our very survival may depend. This was a session of the American Forum of the Air, moderator Steve McCormick. Monitor's Washington microphone listened in, and here is a complete report of what happened.
Tensions continued to mount in the Middle East this week, adding to troubled spots all over the world. The current United Nations success in the Suez conflict is now facing a new challenge. The nations of the world are anxiously awaiting the outcome of these new threats. The question arises, can there be established a permanent, lasting peace in our world? Today, the American Forum is proud to present four leading ambassadors to the United States, discussing prospects for peace. They are Eric Bowman, Ambassador of Sweden, Pot Sadason, Ambassador of Thailand, George Melas, Ambassador of Greece, and Dr. Francisco Urrutia, Ambassador of Colombia. Well, gentlemen, must leadership in any crisis, such as this Middle East situation that we have now, must it come from a large nation, or can a small nation or group of small nations take this lead and move forward? May I ask all your opinion on that? Ambassador Bowman, would you start?
I think in any crisis, the influence of the great powers must always be of paramount importance, which of course doesn't prevent that in a body like the United Nations, smaller people can make their voice heard and by combining their action can have a certain and sometimes a considerable importance of focusing international opinion.
Mm-hmm. Ambassador Sadason, how do you see it, sir?
Well, I see in the same way. I think every country is important, but the leading power is very important. They must take leadership because the implementation of any resolution must come from major powers.
From the major powers. You feel, sir, Ambassador Melas, that a large nation must take the lead?
I feel, regardless of that point, which seems to be rather automatic, I should say, that the fact that matters most is the moral impact and weight that an action or an endeavor takes by the active participation and goodwill displayed by a great power. Mm-hmm. Encouraging and strengthening, of course, the action of all minor powers which coincide. That is all important, I think.
Ambassador Rutte, your opinion, sir?
Well, I think that definitely the big powers must take leadership when action by the Security Council is contemplated. But in the first stage, when it is to iron out difficulties, I think that the small powers are in a better position to act under the conciliation procedures of the Chapter 6 of the United Nations Charter.
And your country has acted in it. You're one of the nations, sir, that have troops in the Suez Canal zone, as is Ambassador Bowman's nation. How do your people feel about this?
That we had to do it. We were asked for troops, and we really thought that we had to do that because definitely you could not build a police force with troops of the big powers or of troops of Europe, of people interested in the canal, Suez Canal problem. So definitely the only people who could send troops were the Scandinavians and Latin Americans, mm-hmm. and some of the Asians, of course.
Ambassador Bowman, in Sweden, do people feel that way about it? Do they voluntarily agree that they should?
Oh, yes, I think they definitely did. It was a kind of duty which we had to perform. Of course, it causes some difficulties because we have to take volunteers. We can't send troops outside Sweden in any other way. But I think the whole of the Swedish nation thought it was a foregone conclusion that we should accept this charge as a kind of contribution to world peace.
Well, that, of course, leads to the question, should this UN police force be made permanent? And other questions, should all members supply troops? We have new troubles breaking out quite often, such as Iraq, Syria now. Should we send missions there to check up on what's going on, or should we have a police force we could send? What should be done in this situation? Ambassador Sadason, how do you see that?
Well, I think we should have a permanent police force that would exercise this function. For instance, before a crisis should actually arise, if a police force that is belong to the United Nations, being impartial, report to the General Assembly, it would greatly assist the member nations.
I see. Do you feel that you get enough reports now? Do you get enough information to make decisions?
Well, there are various reports from time to time, but we get reports from the Secretary General, who is authorized to go to the troubled area.
Of course, you don't get into some troubled areas sometimes.
That's right.
Well, how can you do that? Mr. Melas, how do you see it? How could you get into these troubled areas to find out, to satisfy your own curiosity, exactly what's going on? What should
be
done?
I think that however great the difficulties in sometimes penetrating in certain parts of the world where there would be good reason to do so, in the end, it will be impossible for anybody to withhold at least the examination and the investigation by the international organ that we have set up for peace. Mm-hmm. And that with time, and this crisis has proved it, I think, adequately, the importance and the value of our great organization has increased by leaps and bounds, and I think it will hitherto be, henceforward, be most impossible for anybody to ignore it.
Ambassador Ruti?
Well, I agree completely, and I think even more. You know, we need a United Nations force to act as buffer, because fear is a big problem. Today you have that, for instance, Syria is afraid, and Iraq also is afraid of the building up of the Soviet arms in Syria. So I think it would be very important to act now, because it's easier to act before a conflict than after the conflict has already started. So in my opinion, I definitely would be in favor of sending some kind of observation group and even forces to act as a buffer between the two countries.
Right now, to Iraq and Syria?
Before the conflict starts, definitely.
Uh-huh. You think that might solve the problem and that we...
Not solve, but maybe prevent.
Prevent further difficulties and troubles.
I might add that...
Mr. Saracen.
I might add that if a United Nations force can be established and become effective, that would eliminate forces of small countries that are spending large sums of money to maintain their national armies. For small countries, it is a drain on the economy to maintain forces. It may come to a stage where small countries need not have armies at all.
Oh, you think that might happen?
I'm just thinking out loud.
Would this question of money stop perhaps the inauguration of such a thing as an international police force at the UN, Ambassador Bowman?
Oh, I don't think so. I think you could find ways and means of doing it. I think it's a question which is bound to come up at the United Nations, this of establishing a more permanent force, because otherwise it takes too long a time to organize such a force. How it should be done is, of course, an open question which has to be studied very carefully. I do not quite agree with my friend to the left here that that would make it unnecessary for smaller countries to have their own defense force. I think we still are such in a troubled world that that would be necessary. I think a UN police force is more or less of a symbolic character. It has the world organization behind it. It can very well act as a buffer, as my friend Ambassador Ruchia said, but it won't eliminate the necessity even for smaller countries to have their own defense force, I think. For a long time to come, in any case.
You know, maybe I can give you some information on that, because we were working yesterday on the basis of this UN force. And the general idea is this, that the countries will provide the forces, and then they will continue to pay the salaries they pay in their countries. So that it won't be too much of an effort to send the troops to the UN. This is that each country will continue to pay what they are paying actually to their own forces in their countries, so that the UN will pay for the equipment and maybe, of course, the expense of maintaining the force there. But anyhow, I think it's much better to do that than to get into a war, because that may be cost a thousand times more.
But
than
what
that.
I especially meant was that what can be important is that there should be, even in peacetime, when there is no trouble, certain forces in certain countries available to this purpose.
Well, would you allow all members then to participate in this police force? And wouldn't the question arise, supposing one member causes trouble, suppose this happens, would he not have his troops in the police force too?
I suppose the Secretary General of the Assembly will appeal to certain countries in their police force. Would be used.
Yes, we cannot send the same forces to all the areas of the world.
No.
I think we should divide this into two categories. That is to say, a force to investigate and report, prevent any conflict which may arise. And then the stage which I mentioned a few minutes ago was there should be a sort of United Nations army that could take effective step against an aggressor. I didn't mean to say that we should disband our national forces immediately. I mean to say that eventually we may arrive at a stage where national force may not be necessary or very small.
That would be the ultimate.
Yes, the ultimate. Mm-hmm.
Ambassador,
I think that we have achieved a distinct progress. This time we have a force, an actual force, whether symbolic or not, actually in the field of the unrest and trouble. And I think that it is permitting a clearing up of the situation to a considerable degree. I recall that some years ago, the presence of the United Nations in the mere sense of a symbolic presence by observers in UNSCO, when we had trouble on our frontier, was enough. Not that it stopped the hot war we had to indulge in then to keep the independence and sovereignty of our country, but it did allay certain fear, dangers, and was very annoying to those that were attacking Greece. Now, a force, an actual force, whether it is not too great, is much more than that, and will, I'm sure, perform a great mission. And in this particular conflict where we are all so thoroughly engaged to see a solution, I think that the possibility of using a cordon of sorts will be the best means for providing the possibility of studying and working out a permanent solution. For passions have risen so high in the meanwhile. Mm-hmm.
Do you go along with Ambassador Rutri in that he feels that the search missions, or perhaps even forces, should get into Iraq and Syria, or at least into that affair right now, and do something?
Well, that I don't know. I'm not quite sure whether that is quite the course, because I don't know how far things have gone. Information has been but little so far. There is alarming information, but it's not quite checked and double-checked. We should know more definitely, I think.
Yeah,
but in principle, I agree with the ambassador that, of course, we must be in a position to be there preventively to investigate and, if necessary, to cover, as the army, the emergency forces are supposed to be doing.
Yeah, but Ambassador, there's one point. We already have a letter from one of the countries asking us to do something.
Oh, you mean the Syrian?
The Syrian. So yes. I think that the normal answer we could take tomorrow, the day after tomorrow, is say, all right, for the time being, we send a group of observers.
Yes.
Because, of course, they must accept it, but I suppose they will accept because they have
asked. Yes, that is a very interesting course, of course. Mm-hmm.
So that would be a first step.
You think there's a likelihood, Mr. Ambassador, that might happen in the UN?
Well, it only came yesterday, and we haven't been in New York, but definitely it's my idea, and I hope that we can talk that over in New York tomorrow, Tuesday.
Ambassador Saracen, do you feel that recent developments now in this Middle East situation might influence some kind of development in the Far East? Do you think that CETO can fight off communism there, that perhaps in the spring there might be action of some sort, which we certainly don't look forward to. What is your opinion of that situation in your part of the world?
Well, you put two questions. One is what reaction will be in Asia arising out of the Middle East. Well, I think a major conflict, if it should arise, one continent cannot divorce itself from another. So we are all deeply concerned and interested in it. As regard to the situation in Asia now, the tension has diminished because there's no fighting. But still, we have the question of the division of Vietnam, Korea is still divided, and the prisoners of war in China. These problems must be cleared away.
Mm-hmm. You think there's a likelihood they can be cleared away soon?
I hope so.
Do you look forward to any sort of action there in the springtime? We've heard that there might be action of some sort by armed forces there in the springtime. Is there such a possibility?
Well, they never tell us when the action will take place. Mm-hmm. So the best thing for us to do is to be prepared.
You're a very fine diplomat, sir. Well, certainly, as you well know, gentlemen, the United Nations as a force for peace has sometimes been ignored by nations. I think you'll agree to that. Now, what can be done to enforce these UN actions or directives or thoughts toward resolutions? Is the police force the answer to this kind of thing?
We have had examples now. In one area of the world, in the Middle East, the United Nations so far has been fairly successful, at least stopped fighting, and we will hope that it will be able to prepare for a more permanent solution. In the other area where the United Nations has been active just now, it has had no success whatsoever, except mobilizing public opinion, which of course is something, but it's not. Actually, it has not had no success, as no observers has been allowed to enter Hungary.
Now that you've been turned down on that Hungarian situation, what's the next step? What does the UN do now? Does it just sit there and sort of feel, in a sense, don't you feel you've been brushed off, if I may use an American expression?
But I think you must realize that the possibilities of the United Nations are limited and must be limited as long as you have this cleavage of the world. I think it's a thing which one has to reckon with. Mm-hmm. And as far as our view is concerned, we have great difficulty in understanding why it shouldn't be better for the Soviet Union to have people who are neutral, or like Finland and Austria and even Sweden, as their frontier, and instead of having people which are dissatisfied and which they have to suppress by forcible means.
Mm-hmm. Ambassador Arutia.
Well, you know, I think that Ambassador Oman is completely right. You know, the possibilities of United Nations are quite limited when the countries do not accept the intervention of the United Nations. You know, there are two different procedures. There is a procedure under Chapter 6 of conciliation. This is when the parties agree on the action. This is what we have been doing in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. Now, when a country does not accept the intervention of the United Nations, then it is up to the Security Council. And unfortunately, you know very well that the Charter there has a big problem. So this is why we are strong when we can act with the agreement of the parties. Our action is quite limited.
Yes.
When there is the opposition of a country.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Ambassador Melas, I notice, do you feel that the United Nations will be able to settle the great difficulties that one reads about happening in your part of the world?
Well, I think that they distinctly are able to promote them and make them take a form of settlement. And moreover, I think it is the duty of the United Nations to take interest. For as you talk of the parts of my region that interest us lively today, you would be, I suppose, referring to the island of Cyprus. And without me wishing to raise this here, I think that it is distinctly normal and elementary statesmanship when you have trouble in one area, not to add reasons for more trouble, but to eliminate them. Mm-hmm. That leads to the actual necessity of coping with that in a reasonable way within the framework of the United Nations and according to the principles and rules that the Charter lays down. I think that is unquestionably one of the effective means of contributing to peace.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Saracen, if I may turn to you, I've read that Communist China stated that it feels that Soviet action in Hungary was justified. Now, of course, this should bring upon, I should imagine, fears in small nations, especially in your part of the world. With Chiu Enh Lai about to take a trip, or rather in a trip now, that's going to touch on some seven nations, some of which are relatively small, do you feel this trip that he's taking is part of an activity perhaps to counteract that kind of statement? Will he be effective in that kind of making a statement like that and then taking a trip? Wouldn't small nations in your part of the world be afraid of some sort of thing happening here that might not be well for them?
Well, he's taken a trip to Asia now, and it's too early to say what the outcome will be. Mm-hmm. But the question of Hungary has been condemned by many Asian countries. Mm-hmm. The Prime Minister of India has spoken on this question, and in the United Nations, Burma has condemned aggression and voted against it. I don't believe the justification will hold good in any country, whether in Asia, Europe, or anywhere. It is being condemned everywhere, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Well, gentlemen, there is a provocative article in the current Reader's Digest, which is entitled, "Why There Cannot Be Another War." And in it, Pulitzer Prize author Bill Lawrence states that in the awesome light of an exploding hydrogen bomb, one thing does stand clear, that a major thermonuclear war means certain suicide for the aggressor. Now, do you think that scientific changes might someday eliminate what we call small wars or medium-sized wars? Ambassador Bowman, how do you feel about that?
I think it is quite evident that we now live in something which you perhaps call Pax Atomica, which means that probably we all hope that any major war is an impossibility because of the fantastic consequences for everybody which would ensue. But I think, too, that experience has shown us that under that umbrella of Pax Atomica, smallest wars, perhaps mostly with conventional weapons, is not excluded. And I don't see that the scientific development would prevent those smaller wars. It will be done by other means, by a more concerted action and perhaps better understanding between the powers and a better working of the machinery of the United Nations, but not by scientific means, as far as I can see.
Ambassador Rutli, I saw you nodding your head. Is that the way you see it?
Well, you know, yes, because I believe, for instance, that the Soviet Union wants to fill as much as she can of the vacuum of power existing today in the Middle East, but only as long as she does not have to go so far as getting into a war with the United States. But once you have the military building up in two countries fearing each other, and each one relying on the support of a great power for an eventual war, can you stop? So I'm very much afraid I agree with Ambassador Bowman. A small war can very well lead us to an international war without atomic power.
And you can perhaps even add that deterrent effect of atomic weapons make also smaller wars perhaps even easier to launch because to a certain extent. So I think we will have to take the remedy against smaller wars by other means than scientific means.
With so much of our attention toward the Middle East, gentlemen, I wonder if we could go back there for just a moment. I noticed that in a news story today that the foreign minister of Egypt says that UN troops should withdraw from the Suez Canal zone as soon as the British and the French pull out. Do you feel that there's any likelihood of that, that there might be created what has been called a vacuum if the UN forces were to pull out, or do you feel that the time limit in terms of how long they'll stay will be set by the UN? Who decides these things in the United Nations, and is it a wise thing? Ambassador Melas, how do you feel?
I think that the mission of the emergency forces there is distinctly one of preventing new clashes. And that mission performed, I don't see what reason they very well would make them stay any longer. And the question of the canal's future is a matter which was distinctly one for political discussion, as had always been maintained by this great country and so many others, among which my own. That will, of course, be a matter for discussion. But I don't see that there will be an actual reason of military occupation of that particular point. Mm-hmm. Once the invading troops having quitted.
But isn't there a question between Egypt and Israel, too?
But that is far, much farther north. The Israeli frontiers are long way away. They have nothing to do with the canal.
No, Israel. I didn't take about the canal. No,
but Mr. McCormick was inquiring about the forces in the canal.
That the canal zone, yes.
To which I was answering.
Right.
And I think that there's a point there. You remember that when the British and the French sent the ultimatum to Egypt, they say that they send the forces to prevent Israeli to get to the canal.
That's right.
So if we take over from them, I don't think that we can achieve more than what the French and the British said in the ultimatum they were going to achieve.
I quite agree.
So the other thing is another problem.
Of course, isn't there another problem here? Let's assume these forces pull out of the Suez Canal zone. What of the problem of clearing this canal, which I understand might run into $40 million and take many months, perhaps six? Who will take this on and who will pay for it?
No, this is being taken over. It is a different problem. It is not the same problem. But there are negotiations going on between the Secretary General and Egypt, and we all hope that we'll get something good there.
You'll get some sort of answer to this problem.
Yeah.
Because isn't this a major one? Isn't all of Europe waiting for oil? Ambassador Bowman in Sweden, you have, 72% of your nation's oil comes from the Middle East?
Yes, it does, and of course it is of vital importance. Oh, I don't think only to Western Europe, but I think to Asia too, to India and to all countries to have the canal cleared, and I suppose that it will be very difficult for anybody to prevent that being done. Then all the public opinion of the whole world will be concentrated against the one who prevents that, because it's a vital problem for all of us.
Are you optimistic in that you feel it will be done, say, in the next 6 months or a year?
Well, I think you will probably be able to clear up parts of the canal long before that, because you can probably make a channel which smaller ships can go through, or ships in ballast, which would cut the route in half round the Good Hope. And, of course, I think it is such a vital question, and that there the United Nations will have possibility to influence, exert a considerable influence to get that done.
Ambassador Saracen, I've read that a good many people feel that there'd be a long period of bargaining and maneuvering amongst all of those powers that have an interest in the Middle East because of the situation. Do you think that's stating it correctly, that this might continue for some time? Or do you feel that within a relatively short time this affair might be straightened away?
Well, this the immediate problem now is the to stop the fighting. And after this, we will be in position of before the 29th October, I believe. That's before the fighting. And there are many problems. The damages, the causes of the clearing of the canal, all these problems must be discussed among interested parties, and I'm afraid it will take a long time.
I wonder, in the short time remaining, gentlemen, if I could ask you to look at your crystal balls and answer a question which is in the minds of all people. Will there be a major war here in the relatively near future? I know this may be a difficult question to answer, but if I may I go around the table. Ambassador Bowman, how do you feel, sir?
I do not think so. I don't think there will be a major war. For the reasons that the article in the Reader's Digest stated, and any many others.
Ambassador Saracen?
I don't think so.
You do not think so?
I don't think so.
Ambassador Malas?
I also think that it is excluded.
And Ambassador Rupert?
Within reasonable.
Within a reasonable realm, right?
Yes.
Ambassador Rutia?
Yes, I would agree. Reasonable.
Well, let us trust, gentlemen, that you're all correct.
Let's hope.
Thank you very much. I must interrupt. Our time is up. Our guests today have been Erik Bowman, Ambassador of Sweden, Fotis Saracen, Ambassador of Thailand, George Melas, Ambassador of Greece, Dr. Francisco Urrutia, Ambassador of Colombia. The nation's first discussion program, the American Forum, is now in its 28th year, founded and produced by Theodore Granick. This is Steve McCormick inviting you to join us again next week at this time when NBC will present Youth Wants to Know. And may we call your attention to the article on Youth Wants to Know, which will appear in the forthcoming issue of TV Guide.
For reprints of today's discussion on the American Forum, send 10 cents to Ransdell Incorporated, Printers and Publishers, Washington 18, D.C. The American Forum is produced by its founder, Theodore Granick. Directed by Frank Slinglin. This program came to you from the NBC studios in Washington. This is Ray Quinn speaking. This has been an NBC presentation.
Steve McCormick and the American Forum of the Air from Washington. Free discussion, the solid foundation on which a democracy must be built. Here is a message aimed especially at you who are driving right now, listening to monitor on your car radio. Speed and reckless driving account for the largest percentage of a nation's traffic deaths. When you weave in and out of traffic, when you drive in two lanes so that you're straddling the center line, when you stop and start quickly without signaling, well, you're inviting trouble, and maybe even worse. Remember, drive carefully, observe the speed limit, and keep a good, comfortable distance between you and the car ahead of you. Keep your distance, and you may keep your life. We hope so. Monitor, direct and transcribed.
This is Monitor, the NBC Weekend Radio Service.